previously on Getting the Mecca.
We have a new member, Oscar, joining the team. The three of them are needed to defeat Angels. The three of them are needed to defend Tokyo 3. The three of them can't do without each other. Sure, it's protocol, but again, within the Hedgehog Dilemma framework, it wouldn't be possible if they weren't within the picture at all. If anything, I think Shinji is probably at his best at this part of the series.
This is Getting the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it.
Welcome back to Getting the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in this episode we are looking at the descent arc of Neon Genesis Evangelion. If you aren't aware, this is the fan term for episodes 14 to 19, and this is also arguably where the narrative starts to go wrong. So in this episode, I'll be looking at quite a few things because this arc is quite jam-packed with very interesting things which change the narrative almost forever at this point. So I will be looking at existentialist philosophy and what that has to do for the show. As always, I'll be debating its themes and events. We'll be looking very closely at Shinji and a bit at Rei as well, and what that does for the narrative. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, your iOS device, or wherever you do get podcasts. It will be greatly appreciated and also helps share the love of Getting the Mecha. And so without further ado, here is the episode for this week. That is episode 33 of the podcast, The Descent Arc. I think the most obvious thing, but also probably one of the most interesting and exciting things, is that this part of Evangelion is where the narrative changes. And this is my second watch of Evangelion. Evangelion, I think, is probably the only show, anime TV show, which I have rewatched. I've rewatched Spirited Away a couple times, but that's because it comes on TV all the time. It's not because I actively want to always rewatch Spirited Away. But with the likes of Neon Genesis Evangelion, I'm actually doing it this time. And by rewatching it, I do want to do a bit of an analysis of what it feels like to rewatch a show, specifically Neon Genesis Evangelion. But I think one interesting thing about rewatching has been trying to find where things went wrong, or at least not went wrong, but I hope you can realize I'm not discussing the narrative per se and how the narrative went bad. No, I mean in terms of where things started to change. Where did things go downhill for our characters? There are so many factors we can point out, but I think at least this arc encapsulates a really bold area, or an area I'll definitely investigate in order to find this, because this is where the climax is almost, where things really start to change, and a lot of our characters assume these almost new personas. We gain so much more information, and there's a new level of depth which is explored through the Descent Arc. And in order to understand the Descent Arc, I think it's very essential that I give you at least a plot summary or a brief recap as to what has happened between episode 14 to 19. And before I do that, I will give you my alerts. Per usual, there will be spoilers for this episode. These are major spoilers because this is where Eva takes off, or where Eva really changes. This is why people call Evangelion a messed up show. And I can kind of understand that. And it begins right here. It begins from episode 14, I would say. Potentially. You can argue otherwise, but that means that there will be some vicious spoilers going forward, and those will be analyzed in quite a lot of detail. And so without any more stalling, here is a plot summary for the Descent Arc. The arc opens with episode 14, Sele, the Throne of Souls. We're then hit with a recap showing that there have been 10 angels which have been defeated. We also learn that all of this has been under close scrutiny by Sele, and more specifically, the Human Instrumentality Committee, the inner circle of Sele. One of the main members obviously being Gendo. A lot of new, unfamiliar things seem to emerge in this arc. Examples of this would be the Adam Project, the Marduk Institute, and the Spear of Linguinius. Further on, we begin to question and understand some of these. The Adam Project relates to an underground project going on within NERV, and the Marduk Institute does not exist. And instead, NERV themselves handpick their pilots and put them into Class 2A, where Shinji, Asuka, and Rei take their education. The arc also questions the humanity of certain characters, such as Rei and Shinji, as one of them undergoes experimentation in relation to the Adam Project, while the other, Shinji, is ingested within the angel Leliel. Towards the end of the arc, Shinji makes up his mind that he does not want to pilot the Eva ever again, but when situations with the angels become dire, he then rejoins in order to protect those at NERV and his comrades. In the process, we then discover the true, violent nature of the Evas. This has been the Descent arc. So that has been the arc. I haven't been able to explain everything and go into everything, only because we only have limited time, and I can't go into literally every detail and every shot. I wish I could, but I sadly can't. But that has been the Descent arc. There is a lot going on, and I say this for a lot of arcs we analyze on the show. I say it for when I'm looking at Attack on Titan. I do it for a lot of shows. But in this case, I would say that there is a lot going on for a reason, and that is no impromptu diss to Attack on Titan, but it's very true. We have a lot of philosophy and philosophical components and elements sprinkled through this arc, as well as Shinji toggling between wanting to pilot the Eva and not wanting to pilot the Eva. We get a lot of developments with Gendo and these wider projects which seem to be slowly but surely infiltrating themselves into the narrative. So there are a lot of things going on, and so we just have to get right into it, really. The first thing I want to discuss, and we might as well get right into the philosophy, is existentialism and existentialism's role within the Descent arc. I would say that the existentialist component within the show is almost throughout, but it becomes almost obvious by the beginning of the arc, so that is from episode 14. And it begins with Rei, and it's from the second half of the first episode where the first part is Sele and the 10 angels which have passed, and then the second half being Rei and what is of Rei's existence. What does Rei have really to offer as a person, and who is she? I think that is the core question. Who is Rei? What is Rei? And for that, I think a better way to understand this and explain this is to go into existentialist philosophy. I'm not going to do a dramatic music section for existentialism, because how we're going to be discussing it for this episode I think is very simple and actually quite accessible. In the case of existentialism, I think the best place to look is 20th century philosophy, and one of the first main existentialist thinkers and existentialist philosophers being French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. So Jean-Paul Sartre, 20th century philosopher, comes up with this notion that existence precedes essence. Existence in this case being the core of us. Who are we as soul individuals? And that can only make sense when we put it in the context of essence. And essence are these roles and labels and stereotypes which are imposed on us. And that can go to almost anything. So anything which is used to label you. So in the case of Evangelion, we label the Evas as human creations. In the case of Shinji, we label Shinji Ikari as pilot Shinji Ikari. In the case of Gendo, we label him Commander Gendo Ikari. All these are constructs, and these are constructs under essence. I don't know if constructs is the correct philosophical term to use, but at least in the case of Tokyo 3 and Tokyo 3 society, these are constructed and given out to people. So if we use existentialist philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre and many others such as Kierkegaard and Heidegger, but more specifically Sartre and this idea of existence and essence, we can apply this to Rei. And Rei from episode 14 is shown to almost have essence and is given essence, but what is her true existence? That is something which is very much up for question. I like how this is played about within the arc, where Shinji gives her the label of a mother at times, and it's quite interesting because I guess it makes sense with the arc, because he eventually goes to visit his mother, and we'll be talking about Shinji and his relations to existentialist philosophy later, But in relation to Rey, it's quite interesting how she's constantly having these imposed on her. And I think there's a good teaser as to maybe that isn't something that's very prominent within her, because of how we see all these multiple copies, or at least in imagery, we get all these multiple copies of her being stacked upon one another. And also just her lack of emotion potentially shows that I'm getting a bit further away from philosophy each time, but if we think about the soul and how she doesn't really have that much emotion, we can say that she potentially lacks what is a soul, whereas she literally is someone, and in terms of the society, which is Tokyo 3, she's given labels and a role as a pilot, but who is she as a person? And I guess you can say Rey potentially represents almost a blank slate in regards to the existence and essence conflict which happens within Evangelion. I think if anything, she's almost the opposite of Asuka in how, when we go back to the action arc, Asuka almost tried to prop these labels and ideas onto herself, and how she's the leader, she's mature, and I'm not directly quoting here, but that is kind of what I got from it, whereas Rey, if anything, she kind of happily accepts them, and it makes her, that is all she is, whereas someone like Asuka may be using those to hide something, whereas Rey kind of only has those and she accepts them. So that was just a bit of a small point. If anything, I just wanted to fit in a bit of Asuka, because we don't actually have much Asuka in this arc, or at least nothing very major. Okay, there is the kiss scene between Shinji and Asuka, but I wouldn't say there's much to analyze from it. It just is what it is. I'm sure someone has analyzed it, but from what I get from it, I'm not really going to go into it. It's interesting nonetheless. And as the typical Evangelion meme goes, more fan service, so that's kind of cool. But if we move forward within our journey through existentialism, and we look at Shinji, for example, I think Shinji is the best example. It's not as laid out as on like Rey, I think, but it's very much tackled within one of the episodes, and that episode is episode 16. In episode 16, Shinji finds himself trapped, or we can argue ingested within the Angel Leliel. And I think existentialist ideas come through very easily, or at least we can identify them now that we know what existentialism is, or at least the fundamental core of it, if we refer to Sartre. And I just took this quote from the episode. I think this is probably one of the most powerful quotes within maybe the show, but definitely in the arc. And it goes like this. It's almost this, I don't know, maybe we could argue it's his existence talking to his essence. This other Shinji alludes to saying that there's the self which is observed, and then he contrasts that by discussing the self which observes itself. And that potentially does prove our existentialist theory correct, or at least it proves that existentialism isn't either, because we can argue that if this is Shinji, he is talking about himself ironically. So the Shinji which is a line, because we don't actually get to know whether it's Shinji or not, although it's his voice, but we can potentially say that that is Shinji, and therefore he is the observing version of himself, looking at his almost hopeless self in the either. And so I like that divide. I can definitely tell, or at least it feels as if Anno is playing with these ideas. Interestingly enough, I haven't checked whether Anno has intentionally used this, but as we know, Hideaki Anno does like to say that a lot of things are by accident. And sure, I don't think he's the guy to lie, but at the same time, I'm very skeptical when he says that. He says that for so many things, including the Christian imagery. And in the case of existentialism, I wouldn't be able to say, how is this not in here? Because it's bright and clear. This is one of the core existentialist ideas. It just played out between Shinji. And so if we just continue on this wave, Shinji has tried to at least block out parts of his essence, these roles and labels which define him. I can obviously respect that if I'm just speaking as a human here. I can respect that. He's under a lot of pressure, and when you're constantly being labeled as a pilot and the one who's responsible for being almost a savior for Tokyo 3, it's not so easy when you're a child of Shinji's age. And as a result of that age, he decides to try and lock out these things. We'll eventually talk about this. Rather than accepting them and at least trying to run away from them. He instead just blocks them out completely, or at least not pay any attention to them, because he believes that that will relieve him of the suffering. But meanwhile, it doesn't. And this is a good lesson for that. We learn a bit more when he eventually confronts Kaji, and there's a good quote for that as well, which I'll get to. And just another quote to pepper in all the philosophy I can for you guys. I'm going to potentially call it the essential Shinji. I don't know which part it is. It could be his soul. I'm not too sure. But if we just go on with this other Shinji, he says something also which I quite like. And this is when he says, "Your fear is of the Shinji Ikaris who exist in the minds of others." I like this quote because it kind of fits in with the argument that Evangelion is more of a story about mechas. I'm sure that if you're listening to this, you know that Evangelion is much more than a mecha story, although that is almost its basis, but there is a lot more to it. And I think this makes it feel as if Eva is a story about growing up, and it's a story about a kid or a child or teenager even becoming much more than that and developing as a person. And I think these lessons teach him that through a very harsh fashion, yes, but at least if we look at, and I'm not going to go into it, but the original ending, we learn that this is a story that has a lot more personal roots to it. And this is a story which is a lot closer to home. And I think this quote, or at least these lessons which we learn from Shinji to Shinji, teach us that exactly. I think we can also use episode 16, and especially when Shinji is locked up in this area and is learning these lessons, that his existence and potentially essence, I would say, is given back to him, or at least is addressed in a lot more of a positive way. I think the moments for this isn't particularly episode 16, but when he visits his mum's grave, as well as when his mother, this is in episode 16, when his mother, or at least the spectre of his mother, almost hugs him. Those two moments, I think, are at least comforting, or at least attempted ways of comforting Shinji in his essence, because he can now identify as the son of Yu Ikari, or Yui Ikari. But also, just to counter what I'm saying, that obviously did not work to the extent of which it should, because he still has troubles and he isn't able to face up to this. But also, I think that opens a wider debate as to Eva and how, not even a debate, I just think Evangelion shows us that learning is not instant, and we learn things over time, over long periods of time, and Shinji doesn't learn things from the offset. He has to learn it through pain and struggle and suffering. And so let's move on to suffering, because maybe that can prove to us that suffering is a part of life, and suffering is a part, or at least a necessary part, of Shinji's development as a person. I think the best place to look into how suffering is a part of life, or at least as a part of Shinji's life, and just as a theme within NGE, is if we look at the discussion between Kaji and Shinji. Kaji says, and I quote, "The knowledge of suffering makes you all more capable of kindness to others." And that quote surprised me for someone like Kaji. And I think I've never thought of Kaji. I think this is probably the best you get of Kaji within this arc, or at least throughout the show. Not to say I don't like Kaji, but he slowly becomes a lot more profound and a lot more genuine as a character. Mostly because, okay, he's been found out partially about his activities, but also he just seems a lot more real and not behind these guises of "I'm the cool guy that works at Nerve partially and just doing some jobs on the side." No, he's a lot more than that when we get to the descent arc, which I really like. And by this quote, I think it does tell us that maybe this is all worth something. And there's a degree of contradiction as well, and I think the show works really well at doing that, because how far do we have to suffer that extent? It hasn't been clarified at all. And so when we get to the end of the arc and we're seeing Shinji in this very bad state, it's being fought against the angel by the end, and then also when he fights Toji in that new Eva, when he discovers who it is and all of that fighting he has to go through, being forced by Gendo almost to be doing that, is that suffering just? Is that suffering which we're supposed to just simply accept? Or can we just say this is cruel and this shouldn't happen to anyone? We can say that Eva is therefore teaching us that suffering is a part of life, but at the same time, I think that's almost exploited, or Arno takes advantage of that. because he introduces this notion of suffering, but he takes it to a very far extent. He takes it to an extent which most of us as people wouldn't go through. Almost killing your friend in battle and being forced into killing something which you don't want to kill or something you didn't want to get involved with, that is something which is very extreme. And so I guess we can say this is almost a bottomless theme. Because we can say simultaneously that that makes us question the morality of characters such as Gendo. Is Gendo... that's really cool. Is Gendo right because of this notion that suffering is therefore a good lesson for teaching us? Is Gendo doing the right thing as a father? Or is he doing the absolute opposite and is only creating suffering for his own personal benefit and that is it? That is all there is to it. I don't know the answers, and that is why philosophy is so interesting. Philosophy and morals and all that, they just don't end. I now want to return almost back to our talk on the existentialist context of Neon Genesis Evangelion and put that in the context of the Evas. And it does still relate to Shinji as usual, but let's think of it in terms of the Evas. And it's interesting because I think it's in episode 14 how the Evas are described as human creations. They're given these labels, they're given an essence. And I'd say similarly to Rei, they're imposed with these notions and they aren't, and I say quote unquote, aren't living by this time, or we're not 100% sure of whether they're living or not, although episode 1 and 2 proof kind of. But if we just slow down and go with the assumption that they aren't living, these non-sentient beings are given labels which they can't refuse. What is then interesting is as we progress through the arc and through the episodes, we learn more about the existence of the Evas. And we learn that these ones have this monstrous existence and one which we maybe shouldn't have wanted to find out about. I do enjoy how Anno has put this slowly throughout the narrative. And then he pauses the narrative by episode 14 to talk about this quote-unquote recap. But at the same time uses that recap of like half an episode to suggest whether this is all okay and maybe there is something behind this. And he does again dot in these ideas of existentialism and how that these Evas are only human creations. And he doesn't say it, or the text doesn't say it, but I think the part that should come afterwards is, are they? Are they really? And that's also quite an interesting thing because we've already been introduced to the notion that they potentially aren't. So the very early episodes of the prologue arc do prove that quite well. The action arc, maybe not so much. I think there's something in there, but on the most part, it's the beginning which proved it to us. And then it's almost shut down for quite a while. It's kept on the down low. And then as we get further to the arc, it's their human creations. Or are they? I'm going to stop saying that, but I just find that really interesting. And then I think the main takeaway from all of this in regards to essence and existence and existentialism is that this has slowly begun to merge with Shinji. This is something I think I saw in The Zone of Enders, and I watched I think it's a movie, it's like 40, 50 minutes of Zone of Enders created by none other than Hideo Kojima, who also has been inspired by Hideaki Anno at times, specifically Evangelion. And the interesting thing, this is a parallel I've even found between the two, is just how Shinji has almost assumed this essence of the Eva and this negative, monstrous one of the Eva, at least by episode 19 anyway. Shinji, as we've said earlier, is a character which struggles with finding his essence and finding that label which suits him, and therefore he runs away from the ones which he doesn't like. He's done it with the likes of the piloting label or the piloting role, which he's obviously come back to because of pressure and expectations. He's kind of done it with the role of being a son as well to Gendo, because he just doesn't like Gendo on the most part, let's be honest. That is also up for debate, but I'm not really going to talk about that today. But those parts of his essence are ones which are in flux. He doesn't really know whether to embrace or deny them. And so I think it's quite interesting how as the Eva begins to gain consciousness as a being that isn't an Eva, and it is much more than that, episode 19 being proof of that, and someone who lacks such properties, although we can say that the Eva is losing those notions of essence, so it's losing its whole thing of being a human creation, And Shinji similarly has lost his essence, and therefore those almost combine together, and he takes on the true form of the Eva. And I think that's proven by the imagery in the episode when Shinji is going almost crazy, and he doesn't really give a care in the world. He wants to kill this angel. He feels it within him. And sure, we can say it's all the things which have been building up, but I think if we apply this philosophy, it makes sense that that's the case. I would say that this is very much a parallel to episode 16. Episode 16 sees the Eva go in berserk mode, but it's not really in Shinji's control in that sense. But when we see it under his control, we see the two merge together, and this aggression is one which is unified. Ironically enough, Shinji is able to not control his suffering, or the suffering which comes out of almost killing Toji in that episode. But in comparison to episode 19, he has the ability to control it to a degree. By the end, most likely not, but on the most part, he does. And so maybe this answers our question as to whether suffering is limitless, or can we control our own suffering? I would say Shinji can control his own suffering, but I think it's a much more complicated argument, which I also don't think would be very productive for this one podcast alone to discuss. The final thing I want to talk about in this episode is just how Hideaki Anno, I think, does a really smart thing with this arc, and I've spoken about it a bit today already, but I just want to make sure it hits home and discuss a few more elements which tie into it. So that is just how the narrative almost pauses for a bit in the 10-minute recap, and I think this is a much more powerful device than many would admit, or at least what many would perceive it to be. Maybe not, because I don't know completely what everybody thinks, but at least for me, I think this is quite important, because, and that's not just for, you know, the existentialist language being used on the human creation, blah, blah, blah. But I think the whole thing on Sele that comes afterwards, and more specifically the Human Instrumentality Committee, that shows us this is a moment to question everything which has happened before. So everything from episode 13 and backwards, what has truly been underlying this? And I think Sele and the Human Instrumentality Council answers that directly. It's them who have been almost orchestrating all of this. And so it does make us rethink the narrative. And I think that's potentially a strength of rewatching. I don't know if everyone listening to this is rewatching Evangelion. Even if you're not, you're watching for the first time, I think it's cool to know that everything has been there for a reason. It brings forward this notion of intentionality, which I discuss a lot more in the earlier episodes of the podcast, but I might as well bring it back now. It feels intentional. So in the narrative sense, and also just as a creative sense, these are things which have been put together for a reason in order to create this message, and in order to get to the scene where we see Sele talking about everything before it, in order for them to talk about it, everything else Anno has had to construct precisely to get to that moment. And then just in the narrative sense as well, it's everything has been orchestrated. And so what is being questioned in this part of the show, which I really enjoy, is just what has been underlying the narrative, what has been controlling the angels and everything. This arc works to challenge the narrative so far, because up to this point, our narrative seems to be very episodic in how we don't really need to put any pieces together. Sure, we get some strings in regards to Asuka and her personality and how that changes, and how Misato's potentially struggling a bit, and Shinji, most importantly, Rei, kind of, but more in this arc. But there isn't really a true thread which is pulled through besides these angels which keep popping up. And so now I think it's a really good time to draw the thread into the narrative. And what has all of this meant so far? What have I, Hideaki Anno, have been doing for the past 13 episodes? And I think that is a good way of explaining, or at least alluding to, what has been going on so far. That's not to discredit what he's done throughout episodes 1 to 13, because he does try to inject these other ideas of the Human Instrumentality Project when he goes to Antarctica. All these suspicious moments of him just sitting at his desk saying that everything's coming together. I don't quote that, but that's kind of what he's saying. Gravity Falls meme reference. And so everything is coming together for him, but now we know what is coming together. And we're even getting more elements of that. So the Marduk Institute, and discovering that's not real. And most importantly, the Adam Project. The Adam Project is the big component. This is the big boy of the arc. And that discovery, I think, is going to lead us down into this end game of Eva, the bitter end, where we see the true results of this thread which has been pulled through the narrative. And so on that note, that is the analysis of it for this week. Hopefully you did enjoy that. I really did. I think this has been my favorite one so far. I think the show just gets more and more interesting as you go through it. I think that should be most shows, although it's not the case for everyone. But for Eva, it definitely is the case for me. And so let's do the fun stuff now. Here is the Length of VA segment. I haven't done this in ages. Here is the Length of VA segment for this week. To quickly explain, the Length of VA segment is very simple. What I do is I go into my anime list, find the anime which we're watching, in this case, Neon Genesis Evangelion 1995, go to the variety of roles which are in the show. So in this case, we are looking at Toji, find one of those roles. So Toji, as I said, and then we look at the voice actor and all the other voices which they've played in the world of anime. And so in this edition of Link the VA, we are looking at voice actor Tomokazu Seki. He has honestly played a lot of roles already. This is something which is a pattern on Link the VA, to be fair. A lot of the voice actors which I've spotted on Link the VA in general. I don't even know if we can call it a trend, it's just a thing where we seem to just come across a lot of voice actors who have played a lot of characters, or at least have voiced a lot of characters. So the three voices which I'm looking at in today's episode are Mariko from Mirai Nikki or The Future Diaries, Daru from Steins Gate, very excited about that one, and Stinger from One Punch Man. All three voices are actually very different. I don't think there's one which sounds very much like the other, but they are all very different, and that is a really good way of showing Mr. Seki's talent. Daru obviously having the very monotone, most definitely very... Daru having probably the most interesting voice, and when I say interesting, it's not something I hear much of. He's just so low and it's like a low voice, but it's also very whiny at the same time. I don't know how that works, but it just does, and I really just enjoy him throughout the show. Stinger being one which is actually quite confident and kind of screamy. Like I saw a scene from One Punch Man 2 when he's approaching Garo and he just gets destroyed. Now I look at that show, it doesn't look as bad as I once thought, but I think it's in comparison to One Punch Man, the original, it's definitely a step down. However, in the case of that, his voice obviously stayed the same, and he maintains it throughout the two series. And when he's approaching Garo, it's like he has no fear within his voice, which is also quite funny. He does the same in the Deep Sea King arc as well in the original series, which I find very interesting. He doesn't seem to have any fear at all within his voice. And then finally, I'm not the most fond of this character, I think just because I have a very hazy memory of Mirai Nikki, but Marco from that show. I guess he does have what you could describe as a Chad voice, or just a very masculine type voice, very typical, has the sort of, not gangster feel, but the punk feel that you usually get. If you look at things like Mob Psycho 100, it's that sort of thing, or like Aren from Psycho-Kuzo, it has that sort of feeling to it. It's not a bad voice, but I just don't have much of a connection towards it, really. I think that's just because I'm going to be honest, I just don't like Mirai Nikki. I don't really like The Future Diaries. I watched it very early on when I got into anime. I found out about it because of one of those Watch Mojo videos. It looked wildly interesting, or at least mildly interesting, and then I gave it a chance, and by the end, I was just, why am I watching this? And yeah, so that was a very bad memory, but Mariko still has a very good voice. It's just not something I remember that much. And then we go into the big question. What if all three of these characters were to meet? I think they are all very different in their charisma. I'd say they all are very proud of who they are, particularly Daru in his ways, and Mariko, yes, possibly. I think towards the end, we get a different taste of who he is, but I'm not going to go into that. But all three of these guys, I think they would have somewhat of an interesting conversation. I think Daru would come up with a way to criticize one of them, though, specifically Mariko. And Stinger, I just don't feel like that's his sort of vibe, though. Although he would probably have some way of talking to them, He's busy out in the hero world, so that would be a very weird combination. It's not going to be as good as last time where the characters I thought would just gel and then Maruko would kind of be on the side. I'm guessing my episodes mixed up, but we've had times in the past on Link the VA where the characters, you just know they would have such a great conversation. I don't think that's the case with these characters. And I guess that's really interesting when you think of it in terms of the voice actor and how their roles are so different and they're able to play all these different characters and have all these very different voices. So that is the Link the VA segment for this week. Let's pivot slightly to the In the Moment segment just to talk briefly about something that I have been watching recently. There's one show which I've been watching, and this is a harem anime, so for those that don't like harem, I don't know if you'll relate, but stay with me because I think this might interest you regardless. I'm very early on in this show, but I have begun a show called White Album, and White Album is basically a harem anime about how there's this college student, and he has another fellow college student who's an idol. They've been friends for a while, and he has some weird dream at the beginning that she's gonna chase fame and chase someone else in relation to her being an idol, and he's just, you know, a regular college student. So how does he get around that? I think that is what is explored within this anime. And I have to say, it has a weird intrigue to it, and that's because it feels really mysterious. This is going to be the worst thing I've probably ever said on the podcast, and this isn't even like a take or anything, but I feel like this is in the universe of harem anime, this feels like a Death Note-y version of a harem, and I mean that mostly through its visual style and how it's quite desaturated, it's not too flashy, and even just the way the movements are, I got a bit of a Death Note sense to it, especially even the stuff with college at the beginning. Yeah, I think that is where I was getting Death Note from. It's not Death Note at all. If you enjoyed Death Note, you're probably not going to enjoy White Album, or it doesn't guarantee that. But this is a really interesting show because I'm really early in, so I can't say much, but and I don't want to be spoiling it for you guys, but it doesn't feel too entrenched within harem. It's not so far anyway. It's not really trying to push a harem agenda on me. And instead, it's decided to really try and build this relationship between the two of them, but something doesn't seem to be right, which I find a more interesting way of introducing a harem anime. We often get in harem a few episodes to introduce each character. It's usually about, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes where they introduce each character one by one with their own episode, if not all together in one episode, something like that. But at the moment, we don't really know one who or what the harem is going to be. I'm assuming it's going to be an idol group, which will be quite interesting. And then what is the motif? What is this going to be based on? Because with a lot of harem as well, which I've been watching, there's usually some way of selecting. And I'm not saying Nisekoi particularly, but Nisekoi is a good example of that, as well as things such as Hensuki as well. And even Quince had something around that where the selection had some sort of theme to it and why that person was going to be selected. That hasn't really been established yet from what I've seen so far, and that I think adds to my intrigue. There's no incentive at the moment for it to become a harem. It's simply a relationship at the moment. There has been one other woman introduced or girl introduced, but I don't know if she's a potential candidate for it yet. But just in summary, I have been enjoying the show. I'm going to probably be watching it slowly, but I can keep up with the story at the moment. I've just needed something like a harem anime to keep me calm with a lot of the things which are going on at the moment. And so it's nice to have something to relax to, ironically, to relax to, because this does not seem to be as relaxing as I thought it would be. So that has been the In the Moment segment. That was quite confusing. I know, I'm sorry, but I think that goes hand in hand with how this seems to be a quite confusing anime at the moment. And I'm willing to find a harem that is quite different to what I've experienced. Seikano probably being my favorite harem. It does a combination of what you could argue to be typical do, but also does a lot more than that and changes how things operate. And that is why I really do like that show. I hope White Album can do a similar thing and turn what is the harem framework on its head and do some more interesting things within the genre. So yeah, that has been the In the Moment segment for this week. Let's just go to some closing thoughts. There's one more quote I want to sort of end on. which I think summarizes the Descent arc quite well. So for me to give you my opinion on the Descent arc, I think it would be nice if I give you a quote to end on, and I think that summarizes what this arc is about and also how I feel and what I really interpreted and took from it. So this quote comes from Ritsuko. I can't remember what episode, but it's the scene of which Kaji, her, and Misato are in that bar sort of place. I think they went to somewhat of a wedding and they're in the bar and they just have a bit of a talk about nerve stuff and a few other things. And then Ritsuko says, or she discusses the topic of homeostasis and transstasis. And then I'll just go into the quote here. She says, "One is a force for the status quo, and the other's a force for change." And she goes on to say after that, "A living thing is something that has both of these conflicting qualities." And I really do like that. It really does summarize what this arc is about. It's about really stretching these differences apart. I think we had a lot of toggling within the prologue arc and the action arc, but there's nothing quite like it in this arc. This has really decided to make these almost two polar opposites and pull them apart and try to stretch the characters alongside the stretching of these themes. So unlike Shinji, for example, is stretched to obviously meet expectations, but at the same time, but is conflicting with this essence which we've been discussing throughout this episode in regards to philosophy. So unlike Rei is sort of on the other hand, where she is more being stretched in regards to what her existence is, as her essence has been stretched from the beginning of the show. Obviously, we don't know that explicitly, but now we have hindsight of the Descent arc and the existentialist context. It's quite interesting to look back on that and see that that has been what's been stretched all this time. All these labels have been imposed on her, but who is she? Who is Rei? And we don't really get to understand that in full. And so what do I think of the arc? I think this has been the best arc so far, or at least the best arc which I've analyzed so far. That's not to say I don't enjoy the rest of the show, but I think it was very much essential for this arc to be a success. It's been able to build in this existentialist context within it, and so we can look back on the events which have passed and see their greatness almost in contributing to the troubles of the characters at the moment. I think the best part for me has been being able to challenge or question these underlying things which have underpinned most of the narrative. And that thing is the nature of the Evas. Now most of the truth is basically out. It's going to really have a good twist on the narrative, which is going to be very exciting to see and analyze. Thank you for listening to this episode of Guest of the Mecha. That has been episode 33. I've really enjoyed this episode. I never knew that talking about philosophy this much. I do like talking about philosophy, but when this really underpins all of the episode, it's really interesting to discuss, because I think a show, when it uses a philosophy really well, you can almost always relate it back. That, although this isn't philosophy directly, I think when we looked at Id Invaded, for example, those concepts of the id from Freud and Freud's ideas were so clear, which almost every sentence I said kind of somehow related back to Freud. And I really do enjoy that when it comes to doing philosophy stuff and psychology stuff, although we won't particularly be doing psychology all the time on the podcast, but these sorts of ideas are what I really enjoyed looking at. So that's it. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you lovely people listening. If you did make it here till the end, have a great week. I am watching Heroes Rising on Saturday. I just did a damn it, screw it, I'm watching it now. So I'm going to be watching the My Hero Academia movie. I'll be talking about that on Twitter. So if you want to follow me and check it out, my very mini-ish review. I might record one and save it in the backlog for another time, but I'm not planning to really do a deep analysis of the movie. But anyway, thank you for listening. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows: 8-bit Title Screen by Joth, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, Difference by Chasers Gaming, Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Castle in the Darkness by Alex McCulloch, and Anomaly by Eric Medeas under soundimage.org.